Are you a financial advisor considering the independent RIA model and wondering where to start? Start with Schwab Advisor Services. They've helped thousands evaluate the full range of options and can help you determine your best path forward. Start your journey today at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths.
My wife from her recliner goes, "That'll do, pig."
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
A naked guy with a gun? You expect anyone to believe that?
Get the fuck away from me.
How's it gonna look in your report?
It'll look like justice. That's what the man got. Justice.
Hello, everybody. Boy, that music cut off 4 seconds early for me. That was weird. That was very weird for me. Welcome everybody. This is Wreckatopia episode 159. Today's big recommend is LA Confidential. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Rolo Tomasarinos.
There you go. There we go. That sounds almost like that Tommy Tomasino from Sixth Sense.
Yes.
And also joined by Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
And we would like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Thursday. Anyway, thank you so much for coming out and doing that. We'll go on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I'll start us off with a movie from 1984 called Repo Man.
Ooh.
And this stars Emilio Estevez and Harry Dean Stanton, among others. And it is this movie, I'm going to tell you straight off, this movie's very, very uneven. You're going to watch it going, I don't know if I really can get into this, whatever. But then it'll hit you with a streak of absurd humor that really makes it worthwhile. And this is either recent. I don't know if it's a recent Criterion, but it's on Criterion. And I watched a new 4K version of it and everything. But Emilio Estevez is a guy who's like a grocery stock guy or whatever at the beginning. And he mouths off to his manager, and then he is walking along the street when Harry Dean Stanton asks him to do some stuff, and it eventually leads to Emilio Estevez becoming a repo man, as in the title. And in the middle of all this repo stuff, where they're actually repoing cars most of the time, he stumbles on a sort of a alien conspiracy plot. You would never ever think from the name of Repo Man you would get into an alien conspiracy plot, but apparently there's a guy driving around with a bunch of evidence in the back of his trunk, and anytime anyone tries to open the trunk, they get disintegrated. That is where I will leave you on Repo Man. If you have never seen this movie before, it is good to not know much at all when you go in to watch it. So there you go.
Repo Man, but I have seen Repo Men with Jude Law.
Yeah.
Not related at all. In any possible way.
It is not. But there you go.
I have never seen Repo Man. And until you suggested it as your small recommend, I think I assumed every time I saw this movie title that it was RoboCop. I don't know why my brain would do that, but my brain.
Same amount of letters.
Exactly. It was just like, oh yeah, I've seen RoboCop. So now I realize this is actually a different movie, and I have it on my watch list. So I will someday watch Repo Man that is not RoboCop.
Awesome. Absolutely. Jeremy.
I'll go next. It's going to be an episode of callbacks on Jeremy's side of things. Last week, I small recommended Adolescence. Is that Netflix, Aaron?
Yes.
The four-part miniseries that is fantastic and still rolling around in my brain. Because of how much I enjoyed that, my wife and I went back a couple days ago and watched Boiling Point from 2021, also starring Stephen Graham, written by, directed by, cinematographed by all the same people who did Adolescence. Not to be confused with Boiling Point, the short they made a few years before this, or Boiling Point, the series they made a few years after this.
I thought you were about to talk about the Wesley Snipes, Dennis Hopper movie.
The Wesley Snipes movie, yes. This is jaw-dropping as an accomplishment. There are, as I've been researching, there are no hidden cuts. This is all one take. And apparently the Adolescence episodes were the same way. They blocked for a couple of days, then they blocked with the crew, and then they shot for a couple of days. There's no trickery with these Warners, which is just astonishing. I have to feel like most of these people, most of these performers are treating it like a play and are largely staying in character, even if they're ad-libbing until it's their turn to be on camera. Because I don't know any other way that it could work. If you're just standing around watching them film in the kitchen and then suddenly they turn and come your way, you've got to be ready. This is about a single hour and a half in a restaurant in the UK, a chef who has recently been kicked out of his home, misses his kid's big swimming tournament today. He's drinking a lot, he's just stressed. And you can just tell that he's been off his game lately, and that everyone around him in the kitchen and the staff has been carrying the weight for him, and everything sort of comes to a boiling point.
Oh, interesting.
It is there are moments that are heavy, but they're oddly brief. And it's just about this night in this kitchen and how everyone has a struggle. But it has one of the ballsiest endings. There's something that happens, and I knew we were near the end of the film, and I turned to my wife and I said, does this movie have the balls to end right here? And it cut to black. And I stood up lifting my arms into the air. Really, really enjoyed this. Can't wait to get to the series they made after this, which I think is only a couple of episodes. But yeah, if you liked Adolescence or were intrigued by Adolescence, put Boiling Point from 2021 on your list. I saw it on Peacock. It's on Tubi, Plex, Roku. It's on all the free places.
Hoopla. You can get it at your Hoopla.
I think the from what I'm reading on this trivia here, it was supposed to have 8 takes, but because it was shot during COVID, they only got 2 days to shoot this, and they did it in 4 takes. They ended up taking the 3rd take as the movie. So yes, there was no hidden cuts in this movie. We talked, I think it was Jonathan and I can't remember, but it was in the old Sincast days, interviewed Philip Barantini about this movie when it came out, and I'm really happy to see like some of these people that we interviewed back in the day, because they're just getting their starts back then. Some of these guys have started to like make things that people are really talking about, and they're going back and watching this stuff and everything, so that's really exciting to see that. But yeah, I remember Boiling Point being a highlight of all those interviews we did back then.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I'm excited to see it. I really loved Adolescence, love Stephen Graham. It's funny you mention not to be confused with the series, because I was going to watch this yesterday, since we were talking about it today, and I looked it up, and my app said it was on Netflix, so I checked out Netflix, and I was like, oh, this is a TV series. This is, 5 episodes or whatever, and so I was like, I don't have time for that. Not realizing it's actually a movie as well. Mm-hmm. So
it's both.
I will search that out for sure. My small recommend is a recent film called One of Them Days. Finally got around to watching this.
This looked really good. I saw a trailer for this.
It is really good. It's really funny. It's a great comedy if you're looking to just have some laughs. I think primary among the reasons this is good is Keke Palmer. She is just pure charisma. Want to watch everything she does. Love her on screen. And she is great in this. She's hilarious and so much fun. And also adds the element of heart that a movie like this needs to not just feel like a series of SNL sketches. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a connective tissue that her authenticity adds to this comedy. I believe, is it SZA? Is that how S-Z-A mm-hmm. is pronounced? SZA? Mm-hmm. Is yep. the pairing with Keke Palmer, and she does really well here. Two, Kayla Monteroso is also hilarious in this movie. A lot of people you may not necessarily be fully familiar with, but after this movie, you're going to really enjoy. Plot-wise, basically, it's a day in the life of two women who are getting kicked out of their apartment and have to find rent by the end of the day, and all the hijinks that they have to go through to do so. So, yeah, it's good stuff.
I love Keke Palmer too, and I loved her in Nope.
Yeah.
There's still still a line I love, or a scene I love, that I'll bring up in my head every once in a while when she's like brought back that, I think it's the balloon thing or whatever, to the mm-hmm. to the farm, and he asks, "Where'd you get that from?" And she's like, "Don't worry about it." I love it. Yeah, I need to see this. This looks really fun. So I ever since I saw the trailer, I was like, I gotta see this. This just came out, huh?
In theaters?
No. It came out earlier this year. It just dropped on streaming. I think it's on Netflix now. Oh, okay. Now.
So yeah, it came out in like January, didn't it?
Yeah. It's been out a few months. So obviously it's, you know, past VOD and now on to streaming. You know, why mm-hmm. would something stay in theaters only for 3 months? That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's just dumb. That never happens.
Not everybody can go to the theater, Aaron.
That's never happened in the history.
Jeremy, I am with you.
I know.
All right. Let's get on to our big recommend, which is LA Confidential.
Oh, so huh?
What were you going to say?
I said sideways.
Sideways. Yes. All right, Jeremy, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I didn't notice.
No, LA Confidential's mine, so I will commence with this synopsis, which I don't know how long this is going to be. Everything in LA Confidential matters, except for a few, just a handful of things don't matter in LA Confidential. I went back this morning and like started editing it, and I was like, I can only cut out like a few sentences. So sorry if this runs long, but we're going to go with it. LA Confidential is a 1997 film directed by Curtis Hanson, which, by the way, after you watch this movie, you're going to be like, where was LA Confidential in this guy's filmography before this? Yeah. He did a great movie. River Wild is really good. Hand Rocks the Cradle is really good. And he did another movie with Tom Cruise called Losing It, and he did another one called Bad Influence. Nothing suggests he had an LA Confidential in him. It was adapted by both Hanson and Brian Helgeland from the James Ellroy novel, which I also read after this movie came out. And this is a hell of an adaptation for such a huge book that has a lot of other stuff in it. It was nominated for 9 Oscars, winning 2 for adapted screenplay and for Best Supporting Actress Kim Basinger. The movie begins with gossip columnist Sid Hudgens, played by Danny DeVito, cheekily telling us how great L.A. is, as long as you overlook gangster Mickey Cohen, played by Paul Guilfoyle, who's been able to run dope, rackets, and prostitution seemingly under the nose of the LAPD. And we see Cohen getting arrested on charges much like Al Capone, evasion of federal income tax. We are then taken to the intense gaze of Officer Bud White, played by Russell Crowe, who is ready to beat up a domestic abuser who he's got on a shit list, which he does, and he also threatens to tack on a much worse charge if the guy ever gets out of line. Cut to Sergeant Jack Vincennes, played by Kevin Spacey, who seems to be earning a pretty good living being a consultant on the TV show Badge of Honor, which is Dragnet, obviously. He's at the party dancing with a pretty girl when Sid comes by to give him a tip about an actor named Matt Reynolds, played by Simon Baker, who bought some weed and is with another upcoming star, Tammy Jordan. This is all a big setup for Sid to get a big story for his next column. Now we go to Sergeant Ed Exley, played by Guy Pearce, who is following in the footsteps of his legendary cop father. He's getting a shot at being watch commander on the night of Christmas Eve, where the police are throwing a party of their own. We are also introduced to Captain Dudley Smith, played by James Cromwell, who seems very, very friendly, perhaps too friendly. Captain Smith congratulates Ed on his lieutenant exam, which he scored first in his class. Ed wants to be a detective, but Dudley doesn't think Ed can do the dirty work necessary to be a real cop. Stuff like planting evidence, beating a confession out of a suspect, or shooting a known criminal in the back to avoid stuff like due process. And that's a good little foreshadowing about what's going to happen. While Bud is buying alcohol for the Christmas Eve party, a woman named Lynn Bracken, who looks like Veronica Lake but isn't Veronica Lake, is played by Kim Basinger, walks in. Bud tries to hit on her, and Lynn immediately knows he's a police officer just by the way he carries himself. Outside the liquor store, Bud observes a woman in the back seat of a car who has bandages on her nose, and sitting next to a stern-looking fellow that we will later know as Pierce Patchett, played by David Strathairn. Bud, always looking for an abuser to beat down, confronts Pierce about it, but before things can get violent, Lynn Bracken tells Bud it's not what he thinks, and the woman with bandages confirms this, but they still don't want to outright tell him that she's a sex worker undergoing surgery to look like a Hollywood star. Bud's partner, Dick Stensland, played by Graham Beckel, tells Bud he recognizes the driver, Buzz Meeks, played by Daryl Sandine, who used to be a cop. Back to Sid and Jack, who are setting up the big marijuana bust, complete with a movie premiere in the background to make it look even more significant than it really is. However, Jack, in plundering the scene afterwards, even pocketing the weed for his future use, does happen upon a business card advertising the fleur-de-lis, which will become significant later. When Jack brings the two fun-havers into the station, he tries to give Ed a cut of Sid's bounty. But Mr. Goody Two-Shoes is too good to take the money. Right after that, the cops are taking in six Hispanics that they claim assaulted two police officers, the injuries of which have been way over-exaggerated since it happened. Meanwhile, a bunch of cops are drinking lots and lots of alcohol behind the scenes. What could go wrong? Well, we find out very soon as the drunk cops go to perform street justice on the men who were just taken in, led by Bud's partner, Dick. Ed, the watch commander, doesn't have nearly the authority or physical power to stop this mob. A disgusting beating begins to take place in lockup, with Bud White coming in to separate his partner from a man he's assaulting. But unfortunately, one of the Hispanics tells Bud to go fuck his mother, and Bud becomes part of the mob. Even Jack gets in on it when he gets blood on his suit. Of course, the media is there to tell the story, and all the officers involved will be disciplined. Bud tells the powers that be that he won't testify against anyone for a reduced punishment, and he's suspended. This is something that the up-and-comer Ed is very eager to do to move further up in the department. Ed suggests that the LAPD set an example by punishing officers with secure pensions into an early retirement, while punishing Dick and Bud to the fullest extent of the law. But because Captain Smith finds Bud to be of value, Dick is the only guy they'll let swing for this. Ed is promoted to detective lieutenant with his newfound leverage. They get Jack to be a corroborating witness because the threat of losing badge of honor is more important to him than any other real honor he has as a police officer. Doesn't look like Bud's suspension will last very long, though, as Captain Smith has special tasks he wants him to perform, muscle man work that most cops won't or can't do, which Captain Smith subtly tells him he's all he's really good for, even if it's not in so many words. Meanwhile, someone is putting hits on Mickey Cohen's men and taking some of his business, while the LAPD is making sure no one else from out of town fills the void. At the Victory Motel, we see Bud White beating up one of those out of towners. Even when the guy getting beaten says he might know something about the people killing Mickey's gang members, Captain Smith isn't interested. He just wants this guy to go back to Cleveland. Jack, back from suspension and now working Vice, hopes to get a case so he can get back to narcotics. Of all the dumb luck, Vice appears to be looking into pornography, and the dossier has a fleur-de-lis symbol on it. Ed, now in the bureau, gets a call about a homicide at a coffee shop, and which will later be called the Night Owl Massacre. There's a dead body behind the bar and a whole bunch of dead bodies in a bathroom, including Bud's ex-partner, Dick. After his discovery, we see Captain Smith is eager to take the case himself. The story seems to be that three men held up the coffee shop, and when the cook drew a .38, they killed him and everyone else in the Night Owl. An older woman tries to identify her daughter, Susan Lefferts, but she doesn't recognize her right away because her hair and face seem to be altered. But Bud recognizes her as the woman who was sitting next to Pierce Patchett in the car on Christmas Eve. Captain Smith immediately asked the force to swiftly find justice in this case, believing the perpetrators to be three black juveniles because blah, 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 they were seen shooting shotguns one night, and that they were driving a Mercury coupe that a witness says they saw outside the Night Owl. Fantastic evidence. Bud, with the Susan Leffert's connection, immediately goes to the liquor store to ask about Lynn Bracken, which leads him to Pierce Patchett's house. Pierce informs Bud that he's running a business where sex workers are being made to look like Hollywood stars. Susan Lefferts was being made to look like Rita Hayworth. Then Bud goes to visit Lynn Bracken. This scene is basically a bunch of character stuff because Lynn doesn't know anything about the Night Owl, and it's the beginning of a love story. Jack and Ed visit a man asking about a Mercury coupe, promising he can reduce the man's brother's sentence by 10 years. This guy gives up someone named Sugar Ray Collins. When they go to find him, they see two other cops have beaten them there, and the Mercury coupe just happens to have an orgy of evidence in the back seat. When they bust the door down, the two other cops appear to be trigger happy, and when instructed not to kill them, they look at each other as if there was another plan in motion before Ed and Jack got there. Ed's in charge of questioning the suspects. While they're in separate rooms, his plan is to play them against each other by allowing them to hear parts of the interrogation that will make them turn on one another. When asked about the shotgun, Sugar says he doesn't own any. Ed plays Sugar against his friends further by allowing them to hear him give away their drug dealer's name. Ed then sets his sights on a very scared young man named Lewis who's peed himself. Lewis thinks this is about something else, talks about a woman named Ines Soto he and the others raped when trying to lose his virginity. Ed starts to interrogate Ty, but before he can get far, Bud, the protector of women, comes running in and plays Russian roulette with Ty, asking about Inez's whereabouts. After two empty shots, Ty gives them the name Sylvester Fitch and his location. A team goes to the house, with Bud going in alone, who finds a badly beaten Inez strapped to a bed. Bud then goes in the other room to find Sylvester laughing at cartoons, and he kills him, making it look like Sylvester shot first. Inez is telling the cops that the three men left her on the night of the Night Owl massacre at a time that would allow them to commit the murders. Over the radio, Captain Smith and Ed hear that the three Night Owl suspects have escaped. When Ed gets back to the station, he asks the stenographer about the drug dealer who was mentioned during the questioning, takes one of the trigger-happy cops from the original arrest, and makes a beeline towards his apartment. A broken bottle during a tense situation leads to a shootout where a cop accompanying Ed gets shot. Ed ends up blowing away everybody else, becoming a hero in many people's eyes. Now, as the movie cools down a bit, we see that Jack is back on Badge of Honor, Bud is stalking Lynn, and Pierce Patchett has successfully blackmailed a senator to get a favorable ruling on a new freeway being built. When we get back to Bud, he's in a room where another out-of-town gangster is getting beaten, and he looks fed up with it, driving off while Captain Smith stares daggers at his car. Bud visits Lynn, and she actually seems to want to date him for real. Jack is at a press conference where District Attorney Lowe, played by Ron Rifkin, is looking for higher office, and Jack's gotten the Star of Badge of Honor to stump for him. While there, Sid asks Jack if he wants to get payback on Lowe, who was one of the powers that be who decided to suspend him and send him to Vice. Sid has paid Matt Reynolds, the guy from the pot bus, to have sex with Lowe. Matt doesn't even remember that Jack was the guy who arrested him, thinking he met him at a fleur-de-lis party. Jack prepares to bust D.A. Lowe and Matt Reynolds later that night. When he gets to the motel, he finds Matt Reynolds murdered. Murdered. Ed visits Inez Soto, who doesn't have her facts straight about when Sugar and his friends left her, and now it appears she made that up so that they would pay for what they did. She asks if anyone would have cared about her rape if they didn't do the Night Owl massacre. She says, "I did what I had to do for justice." That's a big line, isn't it? That's something that all the cops in this movie have to do. Nobody comes off clean. Back to Bud and Lynn, where Bud basically explains why he's been a protector of women throughout the movie. His dad used to beat her and him, and while he was tied to a radiator, he watched as his dad killed his mother. Then he left and was never seen again. He believes the Night Owl killers are still out there, and something else is deeply wrong that he can't figure out out yet. Also, years of being told that he's not smart enough to be a real detective have become a part of his own mindset. But Lynn tells him he's wrong, reminding him that he was plenty smart enough to find Pierce and herself. An inspired Bud goes to forensics asking about the Night Owl case. The guy there reminds Bud that the case is closed. Bud notices someone was sitting next to Dick Stensland in the photographs, and the forensics guy reminds him about Susan Lefferts. Bud goes to talk to Susan's mother, who tells him that Dick, Susan, and another man came by the house when she wasn't there. A neighbor told her that she heard a ruckus and that she saw people going under the house multiple times. Bud goes to look at the cellar, where he locates a rotting corpse who used to be Buzz Meeks, Pierce Patchett's former driver. Now Ed comes by forensics and asks the guy there about the Night Owl case and finds out where Bud went, and he discovers the same corpse Bud found. Ed's suspicious of Bud, so he asks Jack to tail him. When Jack doesn't budge, Ed asks him if he believes the Night Owl massacre was properly solved, to which Jack asks why he's still interested in a closed case. Ed tells Jack about Rollo Tomasi, the name he gave the man who killed his father. Rollo Tomasi is why Ed became a cop, to put away people who think they can get away with crimes. Ed eventually inspires Jack to help him. Jack tells Ed about the Matt Reynolds murder, and they agree to help each other with their cases. Bud pays a visit to Johnny Stompanato, Mickey Cohen's former right-hand man, and asks about Buzz Meeks. Johnny tells him that he heard Meeks had a line on a large supply of heroin, which sounds like nonsense because he would need help selling it without getting caught. Jack and Ed follow Bud from the bar to Lynn's place, where they peep on Bud and Lynn about to have sex. Ed and Jack ask Pierce Patchett why Bud White is seeing Lynn Bracken, but Pierce suggests it's for the usual reasons. Ed wants to go back and check up on Lynn, and he tells Jack to ID the corpse he found under Mrs. Leffert's house, which he eventually finds out was Buzz Meeks. As Ed and Jack leave the house, Pierce calls Sid Hudgens for some reason. Hey, I thought he didn't know that guy. Ed visits Lynn, who tells him that she's seeing Bud because she wants to, which Ed doesn't believe, but Ed can't resist kissing her, and they soon start having sex, with Sid taking pictures from a hiding place. Most convenient shit ever. Jack visits Captain Smith and tells them about Buzz Meeks. Meeks and Dick Stensland were investigating Pierce Patchett, who was using Sid Hudgens for blackmail schemes. Jack tells Captain Smith that the charges were dropped because of insufficient evidence, but he also asks him, since he was the supervising officer, if he remembered anything about the case. Smith confirms that Jack hasn't told Ed about this before shooting Jack. When Smith asks Jack if he has a valediction, he says Rollo Tomasi, which I don't even know how he know what he knows to do with those words, but man, it works out for the plot really well. The next day, Smith asks Ed about Rollo Tomasi, which is a made-up name that Ed only told Jack about the previous night, and therefore immediately tells Ed that Smith killed him. Ed goes down to the morgue and finds out that Jack learned the ID of the corpse was ex-cop Buzz Meeks. Meanwhile, Bud is sent to the Victory Motel to do some dirty work on Sid Hudgens, who's tied up. When Smith asks Pierce Patchett about Pierce Patchett and blackmail, Bud rushes outside to find pictures in Sid's trunk that show Ed and Lynn together. Bud immediately drives off to see Lynn. Smith then kills Sid. Lynn is when everybody dies in this movie. Lynn is waiting. Lynn is waiting, knowing an angry Bud is about to show up. Bud starts hitting Lynn, which makes him realize he's a monster, and he runs away. Meanwhile, Ed finds out that Smith was the supervising officer on the Meek Stensland vice cases. Bud shows up and shows Ed the pictures Sid took of him and Lynn. Bud starts beating up Ed, but Ed eventually pulls a gun on him and tells him that Captain Smith killed Jack and that he wants Bud to kill him. Bud gets a few more punches in before finally realizing Ed is right. Bud believes that Dick Stensland killed Buzz Meeks over a big shipment of heroin, and that Dick died at the Night Owl not too long after. Ed tells Bud that the rape victim lied about the three dead suspects, and that the two officers who were at Sugar Ray Collins' house planted the shotguns in their car and would have murdered them if Jack and Ed didn't show up on the scene. Captain Smith framed them for the murders, knowing no one would ask questions. Ed knows this connects to the Matt Reynolds case somehow. Ed asks Bud to team together, and they do. They go to see D.A. Lowe, who Jack knew was supposed to be with Matt on the night he got killed. Ed first asked Lowe to get permission to tail Captain Smith and Pierce Patchett 24 hours a day, along with wiretaps and the ability to check their bank records. When Lowe refuses, Ed asks what blackmail they have on him. Lowe asks for proof, which they don't have, and walks into a bathroom to prepare for a press conference. Bud walks in and starts getting rough, and I can't believe I'm saying this for the second movie in a row, but Bud Suge Knight's Lowe out the window. That usually does the trick, and so Lowe tells them that Smith and Patchett are trying to take over Mickey Cohen's old rackets and that the pictures of Lowe with Matt Reynolds prevented him from prosecuting. They go to Pierce Patchett's place, but find him dead. It's made to look like a suicide, but Bud finds out that his fingers were broken, so he was either forced or it was staged. They now believe Lynn to be in danger. They call the West Hollywood cops, who decide to hold her at their precinct. Ed visits Lynn, where they compare Bud White bruises. She doesn't know anything about Captain Smith at all, and honestly, Lynn Bracken serves one purpose in this movie, and I think it's overall tenuous at best. Bud goes to see Sid, but finds out he's dead. There he gets a message about Ed that Ed wants to meet at the Victory Motel. Soon after they meet, they see headlights approaching. Ed wants to get out of there, but they soon realize they are surrounded. And I love how they do this, too, where the headlights are showing up in very secret-looking places. What follows is a tense action scene at the Victory Motel that is awesome. Ed and Bud hold themselves up in a room where Captain Smith's men fire a hail of bullets from outside, and Ed and Bud kill whoever gets close. Bud uses a hole to hide under the floor, where he's able to take shots at some of the men's feet so that Ed can finish them off. When Ed gets cornered, Bud uses his hiding place to kill the guys who advance inside. That leaves Captain Smith, who shows up when their guards are down. He shoots Bud but doesn't kill him. Bud tries to cut Smith, but Smith shoots him in the face. He somehow survives all these shots. Ed's got a gun trained on Smith, but is unable to pull the trigger after Smith drops his own gun. Smith tells Ed he'll tell the incoming cops a story that will end up making him chief of detectives. But Ed finally realizes what Smith has been trying to teach him all this time and ends up killing him outside the room, shooting him in the back. Mm-hmm. When Ed is brought in for questioning, he tells the full-on truth that the real Night Owl killers were probably those two Smith goons, along with Smith himself, that the Night Owl massacre was over the 25 pounds of heroin that Meeks had that Stensland killed him for, and that Smith wanted to take for himself. Ed then tells them Smith was trying to take over Mickey Cohen's former rackets, killed his lieutenants, blackmailed city officials, and is responsible for the murders of Susan Lefferts, Pierce Patchett, Sid Hudgens, and Jack Vincennes. Ed claims that Smith admitted this to him before he shot him. This story would ruin the LAPD, and Lowe pitches a story where Smith turns out to be a hero. He says this, not knowing that Ed can hear him on the other side. Ed pitches a story where everybody can come out a hero in this, where Smith takes no responsibility for his actions, and is declared a hero in what is now being framed as a shootout with the mob. Ed is given another Medal of Valor for his own role in the shootout. And I'm kind of surprised Bud doesn't get one, but I guess he's the Chewbacca of this story. Lynn shows up and tells Ed that she's running away with Bud to her hometown in Arizona. Ed and Bud say goodbye, and that is the movie. Guys, what did you think of L.A. Confidential?
Aaron, me or you, buddy?
I can go first. Okay. I think this movie is amazing. I think it is just an absolute tour de force by almost everyone involved. And it's just a pleasure to watch well-crafted, interestingly plotted stories. And of course, a lot of that comes from the book, is my understanding, even though I've never read it. And that is just, you know, it's translated here very, very well. I think the Rolo Tomasi twist is possibly one of the greatest plot moments in the history of film. I love the way that is used. And you mentioned something, Chris, in your breakdown about not understanding why he says that in that moment. But I think it's the perfect thing to say. I think he is intentionally...
No,
Oh, you didn't?
That,
oh, okay.
No, I didn't say that. I don't know how James Cromwell knows to say that name to somebody else later on. Like, that. How does he even know that's a name of somebody or anything like that?
Why does he think that's like the local supermarket or,
yeah.
You know,
well, I mean,
whatever.
He asked him for a valediction, which is just anything to say before you die, and it's just like... Rollo Tomasi, that could mean
right. It could
a
be
number
Latin,
of things.
Yeah, it could be Latin for "here I go to die" or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, favorite Sunday dish. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. Thank you for clarifying that, because I do think it is one of those genius moments. Even though you're right, it does rely on some interpretation by the Cromwell character, where he has just heard that story. And not only is kind of, you're Rollo Tomasi, you know, you are this person, but also knows this is a possible way to tell somebody else because he's going to ask about this person. I just think it's just absolute genius in that moment when he finally asks him, you know, hey, did he ever mention anything about a Rollo Tomasi?
I do love the moment for sure. I do love the moment.
Good.
Yep.
So good. I just have to mention this while we're talking about it. Watching this movie with my wife. I think she's seen it before. And she's sitting there in her recliner. And he says, you know, does anybody else know about this or whatever? And then turns, you know, Cromwell turns and shoots Kevin Spacey in the chest, you know, or whatever. And immediately my wife from her recliner goes, "That'll do, pig."
And, what's funny is I read that they cast him specifically because of Babe, and
that
the audience would expect him to be a good guy.
Oh, it's amazing. I was like, hey, that works on two levels. That's incredible. Anyways, love seeing Ron Rifkin in this. Arvis, you know, or Arvin Sloan from Alias is where I learned to love him.
Yeah,
that scene where he's being held out the window is one of my favorites, and the, you know, the good cop bad cop stuff is so hilarious. And is that how you do good cop bad cop? Or yeah, it's so good. I like how our three main cops that we're following kind of represent three different ways police force can be, or people in the police force can be manipulated beyond their ultimate goal. Right, like the idea that celebrity, you know, for the Kevin Spacey character, where this is something where I'm looking for adulation, for, you know, to hobnob with, you know, the high and mighty or those kind of things. The Russell Crowe character is the anger, the, you know, I'm just going to get in and punch the bad people, you know, and take care of the bad people in the world and that kind of thing. And then you've got Guy Pearce with the self-righteousness, like the idea of I am the arbiter. I am the one who is self-righteous. I am beyond reproach. And we know he is not. Even very early on, we see that he is not beyond manipulating the truth to, you know, kind of get what he wants in that first scene, you know, picking certain people who may be set with their pensions and then getting a promotion out of it. So I find the movie's commentary on the idea of what it means to have a policing force and how that can naturally lead to these very human things. At least an interesting thought experiment during the movie, even if it's not the movie's main point. And I do like how those three cops really kind of oversee three different areas of issues with that. So three very flawed heroes. All of them are very flawed. But I think it works.
I should have gone first. You're stealing everything.
Well, lesson learned.
No, that's the thing you should come out of there, out of this with. Nobody comes out clean. You shouldn't be coming out of this movie feeling happy about anything, really, because the lie is still being told at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And then I'll just steal one more thing from you, Jeremy, which is, no, just kidding. The only thing about this movie that I hesitate with is the complexity. It is very complex. It is one of those movies that almost feels like you need to watch it a couple times to really get it, or pause it and think about it for a little bit and try to understand where the connections are. I don't think that's necessarily a terrible thing. I think sometimes art can reveal itself after, you know, multiple viewings, and that's fine. But if you're in the habit of, hey, let's watch a movie and enjoy it, you may There may be parts of it where you're like, wait, what's going on? And you may get to the end and be missing some pieces. Because I know I was the first time through it. It took me the second time.
I have watched this movie probably, I'm going to say close to 10 times. And this viewing, because this this format of our podcast demands that you sort of like pay attention to every detail, especially mm-hmm. when you're relaying the plot to everybody and everything. This was the first time I understood the entire ins and outs of everything that was going on, even after all the times that I've watched the movie. Now, that could just be a failing on my part that I didn't notice all these connections. But, like, this was the first time being able to write it down and, like, figuring out, oh, okay, so, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Like, when you don't know all that stuff, it's still a really good movie, and it still should have beaten Titanic in 1997. But anyway, this was the first time I fully understood the whole plot.
Yeah. All right, Jeremy, what you got left?
Jeremy?
Maybe three bullet points. I was struck this viewing how we have three lead characters that all have similar arcs that are still distinctly different. And I kept making notes about this, like, two notes after that, I was like, seriously, how many movies can you name that have three leads that have different journeys that still all intersect this well? And I think that probably goes back to Elroy and the novel putting that structure in place. But as you said, Jack is motivated by fame. Exley's motivated by ego, promotion, accolades. Bud is motivated by violence. And all three of them sort of have to reckon with that by the end and realize that's not who they want to be anymore. They all have to shed that in order to ultimately do the right thing in the right moment. My first note is it's really a shame Kevin Spacey's a piece of shit because he's phenomenal in this movie. Mm-hmm. I love the scene where Exley asks him, why did you become a cop? And he pauses and slightly tears up and says, I don't remember. It just perfectly describes where he is on his arc right then in that moment. He is currently realizing, I don't know why I'm doing this. Why do I want to do this moving forward? I was struck by how much the score feels like it's from a movie that was made in the era this film is set in. Really, really impressed by that this time. I still think the best beat in the entire movie is when he says a hooker to cut to look like Lana Turner is still a hooker and she is Lana Turner. It's funny, but it also bonds them even further together with a moment of levity that they're on this same mission. I wrote down, I'm trying to go fast because I'm looking at the clock. David Strathairn, I think, is a low-key actor with mega range. In this movie, he's super suave, rich, debonair. In Sneakers, he's blind, smart, acerbic. In The Firm, he's a bumbling redneck criminal. In River Wild, he's the awkward, not graded outdoors dad. In Bourne Ultimatum, he's the suit-wearing, hard-ass CIA boss. And he's great as all of those things. And he just doesn't get the recognition.
Agreed.
My biggest issue with this movie is Bud beating up Lynn and then ending up together. I do understand that children of abuse often repeat that cycle. And ultimately, even though Bud has been beating up abusers, he's still basically become what his father was in many ways. It's all he knows how to do with his rage is put it in his fist. But I feel like him hitting her is a step too far to at least have the story and end up with them together. I think it'd be better if Lynn was going back to Arizona on her own and Bud was going to therapy or joined like a boxing circuit or something. But that's really the only flaw in a otherwise absolutely perfect movie. And I'm not sure it's a flaw in the sense that it's a mistake. It's just, it doesn't sit super well for me. I don't understand how Bud gets shot in the cheek. And then later on, he's got a gauze over that cheek, but there's no apparent exit wound. Did he like swallow that bullet? Did it go into his mouth and stop? Like, I'm very curious about the physics of that bullet.
No idea.
Anyway, yeah, I was struck even more this time through that this movie is better than Sideways, even though Sideways is amazing. absolutely deserved to be Titanic, but Titanic had that fucking spectacle going for it. People walked out of
it. It really did. It was hard to. It was hard to pick against it, even though this movie was far superior. It's one of those things. It's just one of those things. It's in the moment thing. It's one, you know, there's plenty of people out there who do. If we did the Oscars today, what would win? I feel like L.A. Confidential would win now.
Yeah.
I wonder too. I like Kim Basinger a lot in this movie, and I think at the time I was happy she won, and I'm not out to steal Oscars from her or anything like that. But I don't know if I'm seeing a performance now this many years later that's so good that wow.
I felt the same thing.
And looking at the nominees, I would have given it to Julianne Moore for Boogie Nights over Kim Basinger.
Oh, yeah.
I think Julianne Moore was doing some real actual like deep work in that movie, and Kim Basinger is kind of like, you know, this is the classic Hollywood thing, like the hooker with a heart of gold that wins the Oscar performance, and I feel like that was a kind of a shame. This movie had a lot of I didn't look at the box office on this. I don't think this was a tremendously big hit, which was another reason why it had a hard time winning Best Picture and everything.
Right.
But think about the gambles that are all in this thing. I mean, Kevin Spacey had won an Oscar by this point. He'd won for Usual Suspects, but like Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe, like some almost basically unknown Australian actors.
Yep.
If you've paid attention, you've seen Russell Crowe, you saw him in Quick and the Dead, and you saw him in Virtuosity and stuff like that. But I don't think anybody saw Guy Pearce in anything, and he's the guy who has to kind of carry this movie.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny too, in the commentary on the Blu-ray for this, Kim Basinger is talking. I think they're all individual commentaries. They're not like everybody's together in a room. Kim Basinger says, when I first saw who they cast to play Ed Exley, I was like, I had only seen Guy Pearce and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And I was like, you're actually, it's like, this seemed like terrible casting to me that they were going to cast this guy to be the main guy or whatever in this. And then of course she turned right around when you find out how good Guy Pearce is and everything. I thought that was hilarious.
Curtis Hanson explicitly avoided watching Priscilla just because he didn't want to unfairly judge Guy Pearce.
That's amazing.
Which is funny. I mean, it's that weird bias that I think a lot of people have when they watch queer cinema or whatever. Like remember the sort of the backlash when Heath Ledger was named as the Joker and nobody could think about anything other than Brokeback Mountain for some reason. And it's just like, come on, man. These guys are actors. These, you know, they're not the character. And even then, if you look at Brokeback Mountain, look at how fucking awesome Heath Ledger is in that movie. Yeah. Like, come on. But anyway, yeah, I just think that's just, it's just interesting. A big, huge studio movie took this big gamble on two Australian actors to be LA cops. And then they, you know, they got Kevin Spacey. They got a bunch of other, like really good character actors around them, but man, what a gamble, and it paid off.
They also had Simon Baker show up for a cup of coffee as well.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
They even went to Mel Gibson before production began, and he wasn't able to do it or turned him down or something. There were plenty of Australian people that were involved in this.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I'm glad to revisit this movie again. I hadn't seen it in many years, even though I'd seen it a bunch and everything. And it's always good to see a movie like this with fresh eyes and everything. And it was it's even better than I remember, even though there's some things here and there that I was like, I'm just being CinemaSins when I'm thinking about that type of stuff. But anyway, all right, let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.
Shh, be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
I
dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what is your super secret double feature?
What? Jeremy doesn't want to go first? I thought of a few things. This one, to me, does not fit the movie tonally necessarily, but I think makes a really good double feature about complex L.A. police politics and is a great watch. I'm going with End of Watch. This is one of the first movies that I was like, see, this is how you do found footage, because the movie doesn't have to be every shot is found footage, but it has the feel of a found footage movie because of all the footage that it's using. And it uses that to increase the authenticity, the tension, all of those kind of things. Plus, I think the two central performances are just absolutely astonishing with Gyllenhaal and
Michael Peña?
Yes, Peña. Thank you. So, great stuff. David Ayers, I think, directed it. What an interesting career from that guy. This is definitely worth a watch. And I think plays well with the idea of L.A. Cops with L.A. Confidential.
So. David Ayer, man, like, he does a movie like this, which I really liked, and then he translated that into stuff like Bright and Suicide Squad. Oh, man, that's wild. So disappointing.
Up until this, though, this was his thing, gritty L.A. cop things. He's got that one with Keanu, and he's got the one with Christian Bale.
Street Kings and Harsh Times, I believe. Yeah.
And that was kind of his deal. All right, so if it wasn't kind of a piece of shit, my super secret double feature recommend would be Gangster Squad, because
I thought of that as well.
Covering the exact same period of time, it's covering the LA cops put on a special assignment to go after Mickey Cohen and his captains. It's just really not good, and I think I've recommended bad movies or made a double feature of a bad movie before. But I can't bring myself to do it on this one. So I'm going to go with another L.A. cop film. I think we were all thinking on that wavelength. I'm going with Dark Blue,
Which
is, interestingly, written by David Ayer, based on a James Ellroy novel, and directed by Ron Shelton in this case. The similarities are just too much. There's a crooked cop underboss and a new optimistic cop. That's Kurt Russell and Scott Speedman. They plant evidence. They kill innocent people that are set up to be fall guys at the direction of Kurt Russell. Superior officer Kurt Russell is using his subordinates and known criminals to build his own empire. The top cop sets his two underlings that are now suspicious of him against each other. Racial tension is the background because it's set during the LA race riots. And the previously corrupt cop by the end turns good. I just feel maybe James Ellroy has a lane, and it's LA corrupt cops. But I have seen Dark Blue twice in my life, and I enjoyed it. I'm not saying it's perfect or great, but it's got some interesting setups and some good performances, and I think it would be a nice pairing with this. Two different eras, and we haven't really escaped the corruption in LA cops.
I haven't seen Dark Blue since it came out, but from what you have described there, I think that's a really good double feature with this. I know that when this movie came out, a lot of people were comparing LA Confidential to Chinatown, which, that's the easy one, obviously, the easy double feature. And you have not only the comparisons with LA and power and land use and things like that all going into one, you also have Jerry Goldsmith doing the score in both of the movies. So there's no way that Jerry Goldsmith wasn't hired for LA Confidential without the knowledge that he was doing Chinatown as well. So I like you guys' picks there. Those are very good. All right, let's go on to what our homework is next week, and I believe it's Jeremy's turn, and I'm actually going to be surprised. I didn't even read ahead this time, so I'm going to hear it along with you guys.
The second of my callbacks this episode is that for some reason I am recommending my second straight David O. Russell movie, and it's American Hustle. Now, I am not a big David O. Russell guy. I love Three Kings, and I love American Hustle. Most of the rest of them I don't enjoy. I didn't like The Fighter very much. I didn't like Silver Linings Playbook very much. I absolutely hated Joy. So he's not necessarily my bag, but this movie has bored into my soul. It's set in the 70s. It's about a couple of hustlers, art hustlers, who get arrested and then have to work with the FBI to try and take down a bigger fish. It has some of the best needle drops and song usage, and I would put this up in my top 10 of soundtracks from a movie. And a great little single scene stealing moment from Robert De Niro. I can't wait to get into this. And just remember, don't put metal in the science oven. That's a quote from the movie. We'll
I haven't seen this movie since it came out, so it'll be good to revisit this. I remember being slightly disappointed in this movie when I watched it, so it'll be good to see it again and see if I can see it with new eyes.
Fair enough. I'm not expecting everybody to love it. Again, I'm personally telling you, I don't like this director's work for the most part, but this movie I do, and it's on Hulu in America right now. If you have a Hulu subscription, you can watch it there, and I'm excited to get it.
I'm kind of surprised you don't like Silver Linings Playbook. Like, The Fighter, I can see, like, not maybe liking, but Silver Linings Playbook is, I thought, was good. So
probably, I only saw it once, probably could have been external factors. But I've seen Joy twice, and I know that I don't like it.
That's one of his I still haven't seen. All right. I will actually be looking forward to watching this again, because I ran across the Blu-ray of it the other day while I was looking through all my Blu-rays, and I was like, I need to see that again. So I'm glad you're picking that one up. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, chat, would love that you came out here today to comment while we were talking about movies. Thank you so much for coming out today. Appreciate that. Next week is American Hustle, and that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. When you have a favorite golfer, do you want them to start off hot like this, like at the beginning?
I mean, everybody's different. Yes, in general, you want them to be playing well. There are certain players that, like Tiger, when he was in his prime, it never mattered to me how he fared in the first two rounds, because he was always going to play good Saturday and Sunday and play himself into contention. But a guy like Scheffler, when he's on, man, he's really untouchable. And so if you're a Scheffler fan, you want to see this. He's tied for third right now, and he's only played six holes.
It's completely ignorant. I mean, you want them to be good at all times,
sure,
to start on. But it just feels like every time you get one of those golfers that starts off super hot, they end up getting cut by day three because they just lose everything after that first day. But that's just a perception. That's not a real basis in fact or anything like that.
I love those sports perceptions, though. Like, in like a playoff series, sometimes I'll have this perception of, like, you know, if the Tigers go up, you know, 7-1, I'll be like, save some of those runs for the next game, guys.
For sure.
That doesn't work that way, Aaron. It really doesn't.
Anyway, golf is good, and every time I watch the Masters, I remember that time that I went there with my dad and my brother, and I get very nostalgic, and it was an awesome, awesome time, and it was a hallowed ground, and I got barked at for running.
It's like you're a kid back at the pool again. There's a lifeguard just being like, don't run! Don't run!
Jeremy, by the way, has an incredible record of getting scolded in public about things. Like, we're at the Griffith Observatory, and he's smoking. At the time, he was smoking, and there's a guy in a watchtower that yelled at him to put the cigarette out. And then, like, we were at a convention, and, like, we're at somebody's booth, and he was barely grazing somebody's merch on their table or whatever. And the guy's like, watch out, watch out. Oh my God, watch out. And it was like, there was no danger. I can understand if the merch might be super valuable, whatever, but like, man, Jeremy was not doing a thing that was worrying to anybody other than that guy behind that booth.
I didn't get a punch on my lanyard at the Masters. I got scolded for running, even though in all honesty, I was running to the trash can so I could throw up. On Sunday, we were sat up on 13, big par three, par five, sorry. And then 14 was behind us, and Tiger teed off after he played 13 and hit it to the right, meaning he hit it very near us. And I got up and ran, and there was like a maintenance golf cart nearby, and I stood up on the back of it so I could get a better view, and some guy was like, get down from there. And I'm Jesus. No, I'm 40 years old and I'm getting in trouble. And then I ended up crawling into a bush so that I could get up right behind where he was hitting from. I was underneath a bush, and there's all these people standing around to the side of me who have no idea I'm there. And I'm in the dirt about 6 feet away from Tiger's golf ball. It was amazing.
I had the privilege of going to another, you know, professional disc golf tournament, and had a repeat moment of the first time I went, where I realized I was standing in line of sight of somebody putting, and because you don't want to get up in front of them, but sometimes they'll have comebackers or whatever, and just in that moment, like realizing if I move, I'm going to get thrown out of here. It's just like you completely, no matter what you're doing, you just completely freeze until they take their shots.
Did you get to see the end of that tournament, Aaron?
I did not go to the end. I know Macbeth was in it quite late to possibly win again, but didn't pull it out.
Right now, Nicholas Antela is this year's Gannon Burr / Anthony Barella. He's winning everything right now.
I followed him the first tournament I went to. Nicholas, and he had a moment where he was, I'm going to say, 8 feet away, which is a total gimme for those guys. I mean, just like every time. And the chains spit it back out. Like, he hit center chains and it just spit it back out. And he went and sat under a tree for about 3 minutes. Not that that's an exaggeration, but, you know, like 30 seconds. That feels like 3 minutes. Gets up, grabs his disc, slams it in the cage for, you know, to hole out or whatever, then grabs his disc, just keeps hitting it like he's Happy Gilmore, like, you too good for your home? He's like screaming at it, like, can you take this? Will you take this? He's just going, I'm just like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Before we're out of outtakes time, I did want to check in with you guys how you felt about David Fincher directing a sequel to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for Netflix.
Like, I thought it was a joke.
Right? Because it came out on April 1st, right? But it's like, it's real.
It doesn't make, I mean, from what I understand, it's not, it's just going to be about Brad Pitt's character.
Correct.
Like 6 years later or something.
Correct.
Rather than like a story narrative sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently this started out as Tarantino's movie critic script. And for the longest time, that was going to be his 10th film, and it morphed into this, we're going to tell the story of, what is his name? Cliff Booth. We're going to tell Cliff Booth's story, and David Fincher. David Fincher, to his credit, does kind of seem pretty game for a lot of different stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, when he went to Netflix to make that Mindhunter series, like, I felt like that was not a traditional Fincher move. Anyway,
it was he and Kevin Spacey that sort of began a Netflix revolution there with House of Cards.
He directed the first couple episodes of that, didn't he?
Yeah, and then I think he has a deal at Netflix now. Mm-hmm. He just makes stuff for Netflix at this point. I mean, I don't think Netflix gets in the way of what he's doing. I mean, that's right. That's a long time thing that he had with the Alien 3 issues he had on that movie and everything like that. He's always wanted to have that creative control, so he gets to do whatever he wants on Netflix. I think that's really an attraction to him. Also, probably tons and tons of money at the same time. The fact that he and Brad Pitt, who they've worked together 3 or 4 times, are doing this, it makes a lot of sense. My question would be, how does it fit when you watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and then you watch this one? How different of a world is that going to be? I guess you have that no matter what, when you have a big movie and then another director comes in and they start doing their own thing or whatever. But like, I get unnecessarily caught up in the fact that a different director is on this and everything feels different. Maybe Fincher will try his best Tarantino, but I feel like he'll just be Fincher on it. And I don't know. It's going to be, I've always liked the idea. This is going to sound contradictory to what I just said. I've always liked the idea of different directors trying to do another director's kind of movie. More in the line of, I'd always like to see four directors do the same script and then see what the movies are or whatever. Yeah. And so I'd love to see that someday. That's never gonna happen, but no, yeah, but awesome. I will watch it with enthusiasm. I will be guarded about it because I it's just a weird juxtaposition, but you know, Tarantino likes Fincher. I'm pretty sure. I think he called Social Network one of the best movies of the decade a while back, whatever decade Social Network fits in. 2010 could be the aughts, could be the teens. I don't know.
Not related, but I just read yesterday that one of Christian Bale's favorite movies of all time is Beverly Hills Ninja.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
There are so many weird ones that pop up. Like, I've watched a bunch of, like, this director wants you to watch these movies. And a lot of them are like, okay, I've never heard of that before. Okay, so you're way to go. You're smart. Tarantino really loves Woody Allen's Anything Else, the Jason Biggs, Christina Ricci movie.
Oh, wow.
It's like one of the weirdest, like, I would never ever peg Tarantino for like liking that particular Woody Allen, and like really any Woody Allen movie, but that one in particular. So
that's
anyway.
Amazing. Ian's coming over for movie night tonight, speaking of Farley, and I'm showing him Tommy Boy for the first time. So
nice.
He's never seen it. So
I accidentally got two different steelbooks for that movie
the other day. I just got the one, but yeah.
I bought one from Walmart and I bought another one from Amazon, and they have two different covers.
That's amazing. You got variation. So, nicely done.
Yeah. Yeah, if you guys want to see Tommy Boy, I've got a lot of Tommy Boy copies at my house.
Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.